Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. Now, this morning, our guest will be Doris Geldman, who's an elder law attorney in the city of Charlottesville. And she's going to talk to us about a variety of issues, including elder abuse and some of the problems facing the LGBT community as our community ages. So, Doris, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit, just to begin with, about your background, Doris. Tell me about, you know, how you, all the different things you've done. You've had a pretty interesting history. And then about how you ended up in the elder law business.
Well, let's see. Reader's Digest version. I was born in, no. Let's see, where shall I start? We were just talking when we came in that I had had a former life in a couple of different industries. I was in the computer industry for years. I was in radio and television for years. And then the universe shined down on me and said, Doris, if you ever want to be something a little more than what you're doing, a little bit more meaningful and a little bit better money than I was making at the time. I was enjoying myself, but not making a great deal of money. You need to go back to school. So at the not-so-young age of 37, I went back to college as an undergraduate. I had never been before. I had been to the World School of Hard Knocks and went to school and got an undergraduate degree. And while I was there, someone said to me, Doris, there are two ways to measure success. And one of those is very common. People measure success in houses and money and cars and things. Mm-hmm. And the other way is to find the one thing that you would do and not get paid and figure out a way to get paid. And at the time, I was doing some work, some social justice stuff, working with a bunch of people who were themselves lawyers or at least had a JD, a degree in law. And I admired them very much in the work that they were doing. And I was working with them as a volunteer and decided to go on to law school. And like many people that go to law school, my plan was to save the world.
How old were you when you went to law school?
I was 42.
Old enough to know better than to save the world.
Much too old to have that plan. And but always being a very idealistic, but very cynical, but very idealistic at the same time.
That's a very odd combination.
It is an odd combination. It's a very useful one. that's what I did, and I was going to... at the time, I was working in civil rights projects for the gay and lesbian community in Maryland. If you look at the case that actually decided the discrimination, the anti-discrimination bill in Maryland back in the early 2000s, it's my name that's on it. I was the complaining chief plaintiff.
Really? There's a case out there that's Geldman versus something?
Yep. It's Geldman v. Wilson.
Geldman v. Wilson. Do you know the site of Geldman v. Wilson?
I do not, because it was not an appellate case, but it was Wilson was the Maryland Board of Elections official. And that's who you sue when you sue some in a case like that, is the whoever the official is in that capacity. And it was me and a bunch of other gay and lesbian people who sued the Board of Elections guys because they had fraudulently authorized a bunch of signatures on a petition to put this thing on the ballot.
Wait, I'm confused. Who had authorized a bunch of signatures to put what on the ballot?
The Board of Elections. Uh-huh. There had been this petition drive to put the question of whether the
this was during the constitutional amendment ban era.
This was back in Maryland in 2000. We passed an anti-discrimination bill. Governor uh-huh. signed it. The legislation approved it. And as always, the last-ditch effort is to petition
a referendum to repeal it.
Referendum to repeal it by the people.
I see.
The people who were doing that, that were gathering signatures, basically did that fraudulently. And they had a clipboard, and there would be be a question that was unrelated to the referendum question that they were trying to get on the ballot, which they would show people. That was the question they would show people. Then they would flip the page and have them sign something differently.
How did you learn that this was what was happening?
I went up to them to sign it. They were still like standing in front of grocery stores and things like that.
And you and saw
I went
it.
Up and I actually
being a lawyer when they flipped the page.
Well,
you
I wasn't
read
a lawyer.
The...
I wasn't a lawyer yet. This was
right.
long before I was actually a lawyer. But this was the kind of stuff that excited my interest
right.
in the law.
Right.
And in the lawsuit that we brought against these people, they got very frightened that they were going to go to jail for doing it rightfully. And I was represented by a couple of people, big law firm in Washington, whose name escapes me at the moment, who did this pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
And the ACLU of Maryland represented me personally
as
the plaintiff. And I was at one and the same time, I was very excited and very proud to be a part of this effort. But it was also very frightening because, as you probably know, that when you're in these situations and your name is publicly bandied about mm-hmm. and filed in a lawsuit, your name is public,
mm-hmm.
right? And,
you got a big target on your head.
You're a big target on your head or on your back, whatever the case may be. And at the time, this is such a long story. At the time, I was actually living in a Unitarian Universalist church. I was living upstairs in the church. So it was kind of a public place also, and people knew that I lived there in that community. And they had sort of glass doors, and there was this big gravel parking lot. And there was people made a habit of turning around and spinning the gravel sort of late at night. People mm-hmm, would mm-hmm. pull in and turn around or whatever. And every time I would hear that, my heart would go into my throat, thinking that a firebomb's going to come through the front door or something. And you gotta remember, this is a few years ago now.
When was this?
This was 2001.
Okay.
So
all right.
14, 15 years ago.
Right.
But we won. And I was very pleased with that. And there are not that many states, even today, that have anti-discrimination laws. Maryland is one of the few. I think there are 13 states out of the 50. I'd have to check the numbers. Virginia is not one of them, by the way.
I've noticed that.
Yeah.
So Geldman v. Wilson out of Maryland. Right.
Yeah, and I can look it up and send it to you.
I'll check this out. I got to check this out.
I think it's Wilson.
All of which has nothing to do with what the subject of our interview today, but which was absolutely fascinating. And
well, it was one of the things that prompted me to do what I was doing. I was already going to college, and then somebody said this to me, and it encouraged me to go on to law school at that point because I became very interested in doing this kind of work. And so that's what I did, and I went off to law school, and I got my degree, and like every other person that comes out of law school, I looked at the debt load that I was carrying and realized that the things that I wanted to do were not likely going to be the things that I was going
to
do.
You can't afford to save the world.
You cannot afford to save the world. You're just trying to pay the bills.
Yep.
And, in my case, it was over $100,000 in debt. So I went to work for a big law firm, what I call the, rich people suing rich people, richer people law firm.
Shmoo, shmoo, and you.
Do we cheat them and how?
Yep.
In Boston, big firm. Sold my soul for a paycheck.
Temporarily, you leased your soul.
I leased my soul. and the good part of that was I learned a lot. There were a lot of... They were good lawyers. I don't think they were necessarily good people, but they were good at what they did,
mm-hmm.
and they taught me a lot. And some of that was by negative example, what I did not want to be as a lawyer. And one of the things that I tell people is that in my life, the universe somehow has different ideas than I do about what's important and what I should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I fight that, life gets very miserable. And when I don't fight it and I just go with it, things kind of go well. And after a couple years doing this, it wasn't just the universe, but it was certainly the financial world collapsed around all of our ears in, 2008?
About the 08, 09 kind of...
Right, just crashed. And the firm that I worked for was primarily a commercial real estate firm.
Oh, boy.
Right.
And yeah.
The litigation that they did arose from those transactions, the people
right.
that they served. And so I found myself out of a job very quickly. When you are out of a job in Boston collecting unemployment, 80% of a Boston paycheck, which is what you get on unemployment, is
pretty livable wage.
Still pretty good, huh?
Right. So, you know, at first I was kind of panicked, but I decided just relax. And you know, maybe there's a reason for all this. Just go with it. And I did. And I was one of those, what they call 99 weekers. I collected unemployment for 99 weeks waiting for the right opportunity. And at that same time, and this is going somewhere, believe it or not, I'm going to slap you awake here.
All right, I'm listening.
In that same time, my father, who lived in Lynchburg at the time, my mom and dad lived in Lynchburg, he became very ill. And I went down to see them, and we had already decided that we would probably be leaving Boston because we couldn't afford to live there anymore. Mm-hmm. And my wife had left her job in the middle of all this, but she's a nurse, so we had every assurance that she was going to be able to find a job somewhere right. quickly. And so we came down here, and we were scoping out different places to live. Her son presented us with grandchildren, but they were 9 weeks premature. They were in the neonatal ICU
wow.
unit in Fairfax. My dad was in the ICU unit in Lynchburg.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we just got to go. And we moved to Charlottesville, just like that.
A good choice if you're going to move to Virginia.
Exactly. It was the perfect choice for us, geographically and in every other way, socially. Politically, it suited us very well. So Dad was very sick, and I found myself without a job, but very available to him. And here was a guy who was an extremely intelligent man, not very well educated, but very successful over the years in business and in many other ways. And he was very, very sick and was getting – he wasn't elderly yet, but he was getting there. He was in his sort of mid to late 70s. And – I just kind of hung out with him through mm-hmm. this, and I discovered that here was a man who I always relied on to be able to take in information, evaluate it, make good decisions, and suddenly he could not do that anymore. And my mother, who was also getting older, even though she had a medical background from many years ago, was overwhelmed and exhausted from caring for this person as well as trying to deal with her own health issues. And that is when, bing, I suddenly realized there is a place for people to advocate for older people,
mm-hmm.
To help them through the labyrinth of Medicare and Medicaid and nursing homes, the regulatory schemes that govern these things that are just Byzantine to try. And I say that even now, though I somewhat understand them. Social services, the kinds of, just dealing with a hospital bill. We got a hospital bill at one point of $250,000, $250,000, all of which turned out to be wrong, all but about, I can't remember how much, but it was a fraction of that.
What do you mean, all of which turned out to be wrong?
That Medicare covered. Should have been paid by Medicare, but they sent it to my dad, who was still sick and still trying to get better, and he gets this whopping bill that they say he's responsible for,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be not the case at all. It should have been submitted to Medicare, and Medicare should have paid it.
Right.
But that's not what happened.
Right.
And unless there is someone there to speak for you and to fight with the billing department and fight with Medicare and fight with all these other people and knows what the rules are, you're kind of at a loss, especially if you're the sick one or the old one or the frail one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into this.
I bet being the lawyer daughter who didn't have a job and was home taking care of Dad made you fairly unpopular with some of the
it still makes me
hospital
unpopular.
Folks.
Yeah, I can be very unpopular with I tell you, I run into this a lot with nursing homes. The minute I walk in and some family invites me to get involved
mm-hmm.
with communications with a nursing home in particular, and they find out that it's a lawyer that's coming in, everything shuts down. They don't want to talk to you. They want to bring in their corporate counsel. And I try to explain to them, you know, that's not why I'm here. I'm not here to sue you. I can. If it comes to that, I'll probably call in one of my litigator buddies to do that. But that's not why I'm here. What I'm here for is to help find solutions to this person, not find problems. You already have problems. Let's identify what they are and figure out a way to solve them so that this person can get better.
Well, let's talk about nursing homes for a second. I remember having a conversation with you before I was a famous radio show host at Moose's one morning while we're having breakfast.
Which is where all of the good conversations
That is where the good conversations happen. And you were talking about nursing homes and about sort of how some of their business models work. And I thought that was really kind of interesting. You want to summarize that?
Yeah.
Now?
It's kind of interesting. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that most nursing homes, not all, but most nursing homes and assisted livings are for-profit models. In this area, we have a couple of chains, in other words, large corporations that own several nursing homes. And I think what you're referring to, I'm not sure exactly. We have lots of conversations.
We do have many conversations at Moose's.
But I think what you're referring to is the fact that you have this corporation that is somewhat distant and removed from the daily operations of each nursing home. So, for example, you have a nursing home here in Charlottesville who shall remain nameless, who is part of a large corporation, and they have a separate license, each one of the facilities. So in this case, there's one that has a facility here in Charlottesville, and then there are other communities nearby that have, owned by the same corporation, another nursing home, which is a differently licensed facility.
Mm-hmm.
And in each one, there is a person who is licensed to administer that nursing home who has a license through the state to do that. They are credentialed to do that. So when something goes wrong, you have this distant corporation somewhere, probably headquartered in Delaware or someone like there, that for financial reasons. But if something goes wrong and I file a complaint against this nursing home locally, mm-hmm. it's quite likely that that local administrator will take it on the nose and possibly lose their license or get dinged. And the facility may have consequences to their license, but the corporation will not.
And the corporation is the one that's really sucking the profits.
Yes. So, you know, in the background, you have this corporation that's saying to the local facility, you have 135 beds and four of them are empty. You need to get on the stick and fill those beds. And they're going
right.
to go out and beat the bushes to get somebody to fill those beds and pay that. And they will do whatever they have to do to get warm bodies in those beds.
Right, because the people in that facility can be canned by corporate.
That's right. And then, so great. So now you've got these beds filled and you have to remain profitable somehow. And in order to remain profitable, particularly in nursing homes that are sometimes getting Medicaid for these things at a lower rate, the only way they can remain profitable is to cut staff. And when they cut staff, that means obviously the care is compromised for the people that are staying there. And, you know, that in itself is bad enough. But what actually happens is the people that are in the facility that work there are usually, in my experience, very well-intentioned. They want to do a good job. They do that work because they care about those people. But when there are only two nursing aides for 100 and or 50-some-odd people in a particular unit within a nursing home,
mm-hmm.
they can't possibly deliver the care that they need to deliver. But the human suffering that goes on as a result of that, and by human suffering, I'm talking about people lying in their own filth, developing bed sores, and some really horrible things, that is not seen by the people at corporate or who are at some distant remove and don't even hear about it, much less see it.
So I think this is one of those moments where I'm supposed to say something like, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. My guest right now is Doris Geldman, who's a local Charlottesville attorney, and we are talking about elder law issues. In particular, we're talking about nursing homes right now. So, Doris, there is something in particular I wanted to get to about the nursing homes, because this is the thing that I thought was particularly interesting in that conversation over pancakes, which is you were talking about how nursing homes can bring someone in who has assets and then deplete their assets over time. They charge a certain amount per month. And then once those assets are depleted, the nursing home is not supposed to be able to get rid of that patient. They're supposed to take Medicaid or Medicare, or I don't remember which government program it is.
Medicaid.
But somehow they find ways to do it. Can you talk about how that works?
Yes. So when the time comes that someone needs long-term care, and let's be specific about that, as opposed to skilled care, which is rehabilitation following surgery or an illness or something like that, but they're going to live in a nursing home and be taken care of under long-term care. Most people, by the time they reach that point, they have a limited amount of their accumulated wealth. You know, we work all our life to accumulate a certain amount of wealth and real estate and all those sort of things. And by the time you get to the place where you're in a nursing home, a lot of that is probably gone already, but you're trying to figure out how you're going to make it last for as long as your life is going to last. And the nursing home is going to try to figure that out, too.
So let's say you've got somebody who's 80 years old, and they're going into a nursing home, and their life expectancy is, what's the life expectancy for a woman right now who might be 80.
Somewhere 80 to 85, probably.
Okay. And, so
but there's much older than that as well.
Sure. You can also outlive that, right? But
easily.
You sort of, the best thing you could do is kind of take the demographic statistic and go, okay, you know, median right. life expectancy.
Here's an actuarial table.
Right.
Apply these dollars
you know,
to that.
85.
Right.
And you, you know, they are going to have a certain amount of assets. Maybe they still own their home, right?
Yes.
And they're going to sell the home in order to pay for the nursing home.
Yes.
And this will cover a certain period of service.
Right.
That house is going to generate X dollars, and X dollars over divided by, you know, whatever the amount is per month
right.
Is going to be going to result in Y months.
Yes.
Right.
And that's exactly the calculation that I do when I'm working with couples that are looking at this. What do I have to do in order to be able to finance my long-term care?
What happens when grandma lives longer than Y months?
Well, that happens quite a lot. And
grandmas are resilient. I mean, you know, sometimes grandmas,
as opposed to grandpas, tend to live quite a long time these days. And what happens is some nursing homes, because they don't want to accept a Medicaid rate, which is much lower than what they call the private pay rate. And I will tell you that Medicaid calculates the cost of care in this part of Virginia. Right now, they calculate it at $5,900.
Per month?
A month. The reality is it's about $7,000 a month. So you can see how quickly you would deplete assets. If you have a house that's worth $200,000,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of common around
right.
here, that kind of that area, do the math, right? I mean, that money is not going to last very long if you're paying that out of pocket, keeping in mind that you have other expenses.
So let's say maybe your total expenses end up being $10,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
$200,000 divided by $10,000 is what,
20 months?
That's
right.
less than 2 years.
Right. Right, and it's
okay.
very common to live a lot longer than that on this, and that's presuming that you have that asset. A lot of people don't have that asset; they've spent that money long since. Anyway, you get to the point where you apply for Medicaid. Hopefully, before you actually arrive at that moment. But anyway, you apply for Medicaid, and you're approved for Medicaid, and suddenly the facility says, you know, we could probably get a private pay person who would pay a higher rate. We need to get that person out of that bed. And what they will do is they will discharge them.
But they're not supposed to do that, are they?
They are not supposed to.
Isn't there a law that
says
you can't just kick these people out when they reach the end of their money?
Right. So lots of different things will happen. And one of the things is they will say, well, we're going to discharge this person. And you can't just put someone in a wheelchair and put them on the curb and say,
it
does not work.
Next to the trash can? No?
No, it does not work that way. People will tell you they're going to do that to your mom or dad, thinking they're going to get you to cough up the money to pay privately
uh-huh,
now.
Right.
And by the way, I do want to mention that Virginia has what's known as a filial responsibility law. I don't know if you've ever run into this.
I know exactly what you're talking about, but I don't want to take you away from this specific question.
Okay.
I want to get sort of
like
to the answer to this question, counsel.
She's going to keep me focused.
You're on the stand. You're not answering my question.
So
what happens
yes
when
or no,
what happens when Granny runs out of money?
Granny runs out of money. She applies for Medicaid, or someone applies for Medicaid on her behalf. She is entitled to it if she meets certain criteria. If she is out of money, she's going to get Medicaid, and the facility, if it has a Medicaid-certified bed, cannot discharge them based on their ability to pay privately against the law.
Right. So how do they manage to do it? Because they do.
Because people don't know that. Yes, they do. And people don't know that.
People don't know that they can't discharge them because they don't have any money.
Right.
I imagine if you then force them to...
It's called a wrongful discharge.
If you force them to keep them because you know, you did figure that out, that they might make their lives hell.
They can.
That's probably not a good situation either.
No, and people should know about a program called the Ombudsman Program in that case.
What's the Ombudsman Program?
The Ombudsman Program is mandated by the federal government under the CMS, Medicaid, Medicare program, that if you receive money from Medicare or Medicaid federal programs, mm-hmm. that you must allow a third party called an ombudsman, which is a fancy, I think it's Swedish word for advocate, to come into your facility and meet with residents and allow them to talk to them. And if they have problems or issues or concerns, including their families, they can use the ombudsman as a third party to advocate for them with a nursing home, keeping all of those names and identifying information confidential so that they cannot retaliate against the individual because they don't know who it is.
You mean the ombudsman? They know who the ombudsman is because the ombudsman is the one talking to the nursing home.
Yes.
But the ombudsman doesn't tell the nursing home who the patient is?
They don't have to unless they're given the permission to do that by the person that's complaining.
Well, how are they going to solve the problem if they don't know who the patient is?
Well, let me give you the simplest example. If the problem is ombudsman comes in, talks to a patient, and the patient is ringing their call button and nobody is answering their call button, mm-hmm. Then they have a problem.
Yeah, then they have to say,
identifiable problem.
Right.
Right. So the ombudsman can go to the nursing home and say, do you have a policy regarding how quickly a call bell has to be answered?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we have a policy. Well, it's my understanding that policy is not being adhered to. Can we talk about that?
Right.
And then you go from there in resolving these things.
So it is now 30 minutes past the hour. Because that's how you say 10:30 on the radio. And so we're going to take a brief break and be right back.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So, you are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, 94.7. And I'm Andre Hakes, and my guest this morning is Doris Gelman. We're talking about elder law issues. Doris, you mentioned something about the filial responsibility law in Virginia. Tell us about that briefly.
Filial responsibility, filial meaning children, basically, mm-hmm. sons and daughters, is a law that says if you, son or daughter, have a parent who owes money to someone, you may be held responsible for your parents' bills.
Does that mean if my dad goes out and runs up his MasterCard, I got to pay for it?
I don't think that's what it means. I really am only familiar with it in reference to things like nursing homes. And so I don't know exactly what that is. I liken it to what we call being responsible for necessaries for
children. That makes more sense.
When we talk about necessaries with children, parents who are responsible for their children's financial responsibilities, if your child goes into a store and buys up a bunch of stuff and doesn't properly pay for it, the parent may be responsible if it is a necessary, if it's food or shelter or something like that.
Whereas if it's like a, you know,
if it's candy
pack
bar,
of Pokemon
then,
cards,
right.
Not so much.
Right. Because the state wants you to ensure that you are taking good care of your children and doesn't allow you to just sort of...
Pokemon is not a necessary?
To some children, I think.
Well,
probably
I understand.
I'd ask Mason.
You know, I understand a little bit about this doctrine from dealing with... I used to do bankruptcy law years ago, and there was a doctrine of necessaries that applied to spousal issues. Mm-hmm. If your spouse, if my wife Catherine got hurt and she had medical bills, I'd have to pay them if she couldn't pay them because she's my wife.
Right.
Right. And I imagine that maybe it works sort of like that.
I think that's probably the same underlying principle.
Whereas if she just saw a gorgeous pair of leopard skin boots that she had to have.
Yeah, but you would want to pay for those because you'd want to see her.
Well, I probably would want to pay for them, but they wouldn't be necessary. I wouldn't be legally obligated
exactly.
to do so. All right. I understand.
So the essence of the filial responsibility law is that when your parents are aged, and they have needs, care needs, health care, nursing home, that sort of thing, is that the filial responsibility law kicks in and the nursing home can come after the son or daughter and get them to pay for the bill. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all well and good, except that there is a federal law that trumps that law that says you cannot hold family members responsible for that. Now, that is not true for every other application of filial responsibility laws. I can't speak for other areas of the law. I do know that there are several nursing homes in the area whose business offices are telling sons and daughters, we're going to get the money from you through the filial responsibility law, which I think they can do because it is a law in Virginia. They're citing a law that exists in Virginia.
Right.
But they are not saying, oh, you know what, by the way, there's this federal law that says we really can't do that.
Right.
So I have seen that tried, and the minute I push back on these people saying, you're full of it, and I think it's part of the Social Security Act of 1986. I can't remember where it is.
Right.
But it's basically a crock in Virginia that it's just not going to happen. I have not seen anybody actually go forward and try to collect under filial responsibility. It may have happened, but they have not turned around and approached me or some other lawyer and said, hey, we want to take this to court and fight it.
So that's a real interesting question. At this point, what I think I'm going to do, I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines. You might want to grab those headphones there. We'll keep talking. But I'm going to go ahead and open it up. Can you hear?
I can hear.
Okay, you got a little volume button there on your cord. So if you're not getting what you want, you can use that.
Oh, will it bring me coffee if I press
No, it's not. It's not that much of what you want. It won't bring you leopard skin boots either. But the studio number is 284-9470. So at this point, I guess what I'm going to ask is if there's anybody out there who's ever had this happen to them, who's ever had a nursing home come back after them under the filial responsibility law, or if you just have a general question for Doris, give us a call on that line, and we'll take your call. And in the meantime, while we're waiting for that, Doris, let me ask you a little bit about LGBT issues. We have an aging population. You were talking about how, in 2001, things were a little different, a little scarier than they are right now for the LGBT community. What's happening to the folks now who are reaching those retirement years?
So, first of all, like every other segment of the population, the LGBT community has a very sizable aging community. And like every other segment of the population, we are entering nursing homes and assisted livings and having health crises. So we're everywhere, and that's one of the places where we are. And what we have discovered in the last decade or so, as this has begun to happen, is that people who in the 70s and 80s and 90s began to fly out of the closet and celebrate their gayness, if you will, as we do with rainbows flying and whatnot, suddenly find themselves going to institutions where that is not the norm and, in fact, are not terribly welcome there. And when I say not welcome, I don't mean that they're not welcome as humans. They are not celebrated as gay people. And part of the reason for that is part of the, I'm trying to think of the right word for it, the social fabric of nursing homes is often oriented to church-related activities. So at Christmas time, for example, we see a lot of celebrations around Christmas. A lot of church volunteer groups come in.
Right.
People come in and sing carols. But you don't see anybody coming in and celebrating Ramadan or the Jewish holidays. Or I had a client over at one of the nursing homes here last year was afraid to put up a menorah.
Ooh, yeah. That's not good.
Yeah.
We got a caller on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and take that call. You're on the air. This is WPBC. Hello?
Go on.
Oh, they're not really there. Okay. So if you are trying to call in this morning, the number is 284-9470. give us a ring back right now, and we'll be happy to take your call. You may have to wait for a few seconds while we're finishing up whatever it was that we were talking about first. But in any event, give us a ring if you've got something you want to ask. So go ahead and tell me a little more about that. We were talking about the folks who were afraid to put up their menorah. Might you be afraid to fly your pride flag
in
your later years?
Not because the institution itself is necessarily anti-gay. But having said that, I will go back and remind you that we do not have anti-discrimination laws in Virginia. So if you are a gay person in Virginia, it is perfectly legal for your employer to fire you because mm-hmm. you are gay, or your landlord to evict you because you are gay. That is perfectly legal in this state. By the same token, it is perfectly legal for a nursing home to say, you know what, we don't want you because you're gay.
So might they wait until you had expended your actual cash resources, until the moment when you were applying for Medicaid, and then decide that, you know, you're gay, and so, nah. We just figured this out?
Theoretically.
Well, tell me about that population and what other kinds of issues might see.
So here's what happens. The those of us who came flying out of the closet in the last 20, 30 years or whatever, find ourselves suddenly elderly and going into one of these institutions where we are not particularly welcome, or more likely, we feel like we are not welcome for mm-hmm. whatever reasons. If I go into a nursing home, let's just say that I'm the elderly and frail person, and I go into a nursing home, and the person who comes, my family member who comes to visit me and to hold my hand and to mop my brow and to kiss me and to massage my feet and hands is my wife. Mm-hmm. It's a woman.
Right.
And that is not a common experience in most nursing homes, and the people who work there feel very uncomfortable about that.
Correct. I see.
That, in turn, makes us a little more reluctant to behave in a way that is normal, natural for us. Mm-hmm. And we see that play out pretty dramatically. We've heard of situations, it has not personally happened to me, but I've heard of situations where someone will come into the residence room and say to them, you know, it's not too late, you can repent, and we'll read the Bible to them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. This would be someone who works at the nursing home?
Yes.
Ooh. Are you aware of that happening mm-hmm. here in mm-hmm. Charlottesville? Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. What would you say to a client if let's say that person's wife or husband called you at some point and told you that this had happened? What would you suggest to them?
I don't know that I have any recourse. The only thing that I think I could do, I would approach it through what's called residence rights mm-hmm. in nursing homes, and it's part of the Social Security Act that I was talking about, so it's the law.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a bunch of delineated rights that residents have, and among them are things like the right to dignity and various sort of ephemeral sort of rights that you have. But if someone is affronted in their dignity or their right to privacy or any of those things, I could confront the nursing home on that basis, that it's a cultural issue and that you have affronted their right to a dignified...
What about religion? I mean, we have this idea that we have freedom of religion.
We have freedom from religion also.
I like to think of it as freedom from, but we have freedom of, which includes from. But... could you approach it on that score? Could you say,
don't go into
the residence room and read them the Bible because...
Well, I mean, as you know, when we're talking about fundamental freedoms under the Bill of Rights, it has to do with the government impinging
mm-hmm.
upon our free exercise of religion or freedom from religion. So if the nursing home is not a government entity,
mm-hmm.
then I think I would have difficulty asserting that as a constitutional right.
What if they're getting
freedom?
Paid by Medicaid?
Well, I think that you could maybe say, hey, look, you know, in the same way that you guys are regulated on all these other issues through the government, you are getting state funds, you're regulated by the state, you're regulated by the federal government and all those other things, but are you a branch of the government? That I don't know, because they are owned as a private entity. They're not like schools. Schools, you know, if you go after a school for violating one of these constitutional rights, it's a government, it's a branch of the government.
Well, if it's a public school...
Right.
There are issues right now. There are some federal cases right now that are pending involving there's one I think Washington and Lee got sued that I'm reading. I've been reading the opinions on that's in federal court. And basically there was an opinion that said, well, if this was a public school, it would be different. There was a due process allegation. But because it's not, not a government actor, so
right. So you're free to be as rude and unfair and awful as you want to be. It's your right to be a bigot.
I see.
Just as the Boy Scouts.
Well, what else can be done about this? Is there any effort to put together facilities for LGBT folks?
Yes, I personally am working on that.
You trying to put together the gay nursing home? It'll be like Tuesday disco night, or
I joke, but I do have thoughts on that matter. It's way too soon. I'm still building a law practice, there are definitely gay and lesbian nursing facilities in different places. Certainly in Florida, where there's a very large retiring population.
Sure.
Also in New York, in Boston, San Francisco, there are facilities that are specifically for gay and lesbian people. I don't know that that's the answer to this myself. I think that, like every other segment of society, we need to be working more towards inclusion of everyone and the free expression for everyone. I don't really want to be isolated.
Yeah, you don't want to be segregated. I mean, that totally makes sense. I'm just thinking in the short term, you know, it's going to take some time to change the laws on this, although maybe less time than I would have originally estimated.
I would like to see us work in Virginia. I would like to see us come up with an anti-discrimination law that would address all of these, because that's public accommodation.
Amen.
Just like, you know, theaters and restaurants and any other place that would come under the public accommodation, where they can't deny you service as a result of that.
No, that makes sense. Okay, so this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes on WPVC. You are listening to the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. I'm here with Doris Gelman. We are talking about elder law issues. So, Doris, talk a little bit about elder abuse. There are many different aspects of this, and I think that, you know, the one that most people are familiar with is just the person who's physically abused, who's left lying in their own waste. Justice may be the wrong word, but what I'm trying to say is there are other kinds of abuse that you see in your practice, and one of the more insidious ones, I think, is financial abuse. Talk a little bit about what that is. And by the way, let me just say that studio line again is 284-9470. Tell me a little bit about the different kinds of elder abuse, and in the end, I'd like you to talk a little bit about financial.
Okay. So let's talk about all of the kinds of abuse, because there are many. There is the form of actual physical abuse, which, like domestic abuse, can be, you know, actually hitting someone and that sort of thing. There is physical abuse that is, in fact, neglect, where you are in charge of caring for someone, but you fail to do so to their detriment. There is emotional or verbal abuse, which results in actual emotional harm. And there is, believe it or not, sexual abuse or those kinds of crimes that are perpetrated against very elderly people. And there is financial exploitation. And all of these things sometimes go together, that where you find one, you will find many of the others. And one thing I do want to distinguish on the financial side is that there is such a thing as financial scams and financial exploitation, which I distinguish between the two. And I'll give you an example of a financial scam. A financial scam is where you have the guy call up and say, oh, hey, Grandpa, it's your favorite grandson. And Grandpa says, oh, Michael.
Right.
Now he's got a name.
But it's not Michael.
It's not Michael. It's somebody, some scammer somewhere. And he says, I'm in Canada, and they've arrested me for some bogus charge. And in order to get out, I need $1,000. Can you go down to Western Union, wire me right away, wire me
$1,000?
Grandpa, wanting to be good grandpa, goes on down to Western Union. And he's told, by the way, don't tell anyone. I don't want Mom to know because I'll get in trouble
blah, blah, blah.
That's a scam. And they're perpetrated in 1,000 different ways. They're like viruses. They mutate and take on different forms. I am not really discussing those today. Those are very difficult to go after. They happen. The best thing that you can do about those, I think, is education.
Right.
Educate people about those. What I'm talking about tends to be perpetrated more by someone we know. And there is a profile of the financial exploiter. I was taught this by a guy that prosecutes these people on the West Coast. And he said that it 9 times out of 10 is a male relative, a grandson, a nephew, a son, who is living with and taking care of mom, auntie, grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And typically they have a chemical substance abuse problem, a gambling problem, something like that, that drives them in the direction of exploiting grandma for money.
Mm-hmm.
So they are theoretically taking care of grandma. They usually have a power of attorney, which allows them to have access to bank accounts and various other things. Sometimes this happens going down a slippery slope, and you and I talked about this a little bit the other day, and the camel's nose slips under the tent because grandma really does have financial needs that grandson needs to take care of. Grandma needs him to go down and get groceries and cash a check for. So he goes down and gets groceries, and while he's there, he says, well, hey, you know, I'm writing grandma's check. I might as well get my own groceries while I'm at it.
Right.
So that's how it begins. There's this sort of insidious, and they realize, oh, this is really easy.
Mm-hmm.
And grandma's got a lot more money than I do. And, oh, by the way, I'm doing all this stuff for her. She might as well be paying me to do this. So suddenly there's this justification of I have a right to this money.
But what if grandma says, yeah, buy your groceries?
That's called consent.
That's not exploitation.
No, it's not. That's
exploitation is where grandma doesn't know.
That's right. Or you fool grandma uh-huh. into doing this, and you tell her that I'm doing X, Y, and Z with this money when, in fact, you're using it to buy drugs or alcohol or gambling.
That makes sense.
And the flip side of your question is, what happens when grandma finds out about this and says no?
Right.
And our experience is this is where the physical abuse comes in, because all of the sudden a couple things may happen. Nephew may say, oh, yes, and pop grandma in the eye mm-hmm. and say, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you're not. There's nothing that you can do about it. The other thing that may happen is nephew may say, well, if you don't let me have access to this money, I'm not going to get your groceries.
Right.
Or I'm not going to give you your medication. Or, by the way, you can't get up out of bed, so I'm not even going to bring you a glass of water, and you're going to dehydrate. Or I'm not going to change your sheets, and you're going to lie
there. Or it may be less direct. It may just be stopping doing some of those things because you're mad at grandma.
Right. Right. But you're still now talking about neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And it has very serious consequences for grandma, who needs that care.
I think where these things get more complicated is where grandma has a diminished mental capacity.
Very much so.
What do you think the line drawing looks like there? How do you differentiate, you know, grandma who has always taken care of grandson and who is now paying for grandson's sports car? And who has some diminished mental capacity. How do you differentiate that generosity from exploitation or abuse?
Well, this is a very difficult problem, and this is part of the difficulty with prosecuting these cases mm-hmm. is when is grandma able to consent to something, and when is she not able to consent to something? And if grandma's able to consent, if we can say, okay, grandma does have mental capacity to do that, and she does consent, then there's no crime, right?
Right.
She's consented. It goes back to the question that you asked a few minutes ago. But if grandma is not able to consent, you may have to go back and look at the history of what she has done and say, okay, well, she in the past has always given her permission to do this. And then that becomes a very difficult case to prove as well. But the fulcrum that all of this turns on is, does grandma have capacity or not?
And what is capacity, Dora?
Capacity, in its simplest terms, is the ability to understand the consequences of your decision, right? So if somebody puts a piece of paper in front of me, and that piece of paper is a power of attorney that says this person has access to my bank accounts, if I have mental capacity to understand what the consequences of that are. And let me give you an example, because I think that's much easier for most people to understand. If I have a person who lacks capacity, let's say they have some kind of cognitive disability, have always had a cognitive disability, developmentally disabled, for example, and that person has in their hand $500 in cash and walks onto a car lot and says to the salesman, I want to buy that Mustang out there, that shiny red Mustang. Here's $500. And salesman being salesman goes to his guy and they draw up a contract. And they say this is a $500 down payment and 72 months of payments and blah, 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 and that and bring it back. And the gentleman who wants to buy the car signs that contract and does not understand that he has obligated himself for 72 months of payments.
Right.
That contract is not valid, and I can't remember whether
it's void or voidable.
Because he did not understand what he was signing. He did not understand the consequences of obligating himself to 72 months of payments. The same thing is true for older people who lack the capacity to understand their decisions have consequences. So if I give this nephew a power of attorney to do these things, did I understand what I was giving him? Did I understand that this gambling nephew of mine could drain my bank accounts for his gambling purposes, even though I gave him the keys to the castle?
Well, a power of attorney requires that you act in the person's interest, doesn't
it?
That gave you the power of attorney. So
it does.
A power of attorney, while it gives you the power, sort of carte blanche, to do things, it doesn't give you the authority to do
everything.
That's correct.
So it's still a crime to steal somebody's money under color of a power of attorney if you are not acting in that person's best interest. So you're giving them the means to do it. You're not necessarily consenting to them doing it. But then you have to prove it, because if nephew says, Grandma said I could do that and gave me the means, how are you going to disprove that?
Right.
It's very difficult.
It does become very difficult to do. So as I was preparing for you to come on my show, Doris, I was doing a little research that my lovely producer, Olivia August, had had begun for me and set out. And I found something just really fascinating and also really sort of off the train of what we're talking about right now, which is there's a lot of an odd curve to the population in Japan right now in terms of aging. And so there are some studies being done on the Japanese population involving aging and how Japan is dealing with this problem that are being looked at to kind of go, hey, you know, how maybe should we be thinking about it? And I found this crazy thing that's happening in Japan, which is that they are developing these robot caregivers.
Wow.
And some of them look like people. Some of them look like the one that
well, they sort of look like people.
So, yeah, I mean, well, they look like mannequins. Yeah. Some of them look more like, you know, they're clearly robots. Some of them look like stuffed animals. There are some that look like little baby seals that were one of the prototypes that they were using. And the idea was that they would kind of keep the elderly person's mind engaged. They'd be like the toys you had as a kid that would play games with you or whatever. Be like a Furby. And then some of the other ones are designed to be able to lift you or, you know, take you out of bed or, you know, and provide healthcare. I'm just curious if you have ever looked at any of that before or what you think about it in terms of the future of elder care. If you think that we might ever end up in that place?
It's a fascinating subject. I have not run across this yet. I will say one of the first things that came to mind when I looked at this was when you go into nursing homes, and I know a lot of people are very uncomfortable going into nursing homes for a variety of reasons. But if you ever do go into them and spend any time, there are two things that you'll see that bring a lot of comfort to older people, especially people with dementia. One is dolls. You will see a lot of older women and some older men carrying stuffed animals and dolls like babies, and they get a great deal of comfort from that. And they carry them everywhere they go, and they care for them.
Sort of like a child.
Yeah.
Maybe we kind of regress back.
So that's one thing. The other thing that you see a lot of is pet therapy. There are a number of people that go in and take dogs and cats and things, even horses in some places I've seen. where obviously the residents come outside to visit with the horses. But they get a great deal of comfort from that, just that contact with another living, warm, non-threatening body,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is part of the battle. When you talk about the actual care of people, we already have devices and things like that that are very much alleviating some of the strain from the physical caregivers. Things like Hoyer lifts. A Hoyer lift is designed to save the back and ease things and fewer people to actually get someone out of a bed. So, yes, we're definitely moving in that direction. With that said, I believe that this work is done by very special people. And it's people with heart. It's people that are willing to do this at a very low rate. They do not get paid well. They do not get thank yous. They do not get bonuses. They work on holidays, weekends, long shifts. I have often thought that there are a lot of people out there that would do this work gladly. And I don't know that we have any particular reason to replace them with droids or robots when we have such a serious problem with unemployment. It's a matter of training the right people to do this work and do it
so
well.
So no Android for you?
No. No, I think we can pay them a decent wage.
I might want a baby seal. I don't know. But
well, baby seal.
We'll see how it goes.
Maybe.
Maybe the baby seal.
That goes with the pet therapy.
Hey, it works. I find my kitties very comforting.
Absolutely. And they know
44,
when I need it.
So,
both the dog and the cat will.
I'm sure that will continue well beyond my ability to use words.
Don't you worry, Andre. I will be there.
Okay. I appreciate that, Doris. We are wrapping up. This has been Straight Talk. On WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. I'm Andre Hakes. My guest this morning has been Doris Geldman on elder care issues. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. All right, have a good weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville.